In some instances, this was because the Christian government withdrew its support. But even more, it was the result of the conversion of the upper classes. Local pagan cults were almost always supported by local pagan aristocrats. As the Roman upper classes increasingly became Christian, naturally their resources were redirected to the church. It was not just in converts, but also in cash, that traditional religions experienced a massive collapse over time, with the Christian church experiencing a growth that was literally exponential. Paganism did not have to be destroyed by violent acts of Christian intolerance. It could and did die a natural death, cut off from resources and abandoned by popular opinion. Afterward, gains and losses. The idea for this book struck me 20 years ago during my first trip to Athens. I was keen to explore the archaeological wonders of the city, and most especially the Agora and the Acropolis. The Agora was the ancient center of the city, and is still filled with monumental buildings. The old Athenian meeting place called the Metrune. The impressively reconstructed South Stoa with its rooms, shops, and areas for people to mingle. And a number of ruined sacred sites, including the single best-preserved Greek temple to come down to us from antiquity, one dedicated to the Greek god Hephaestus, god of volcanoes, fire, and metalworking. Constructed from 449 to 415 BCE during the glory days of Athens, the temple is a large and imposing structure in the northwest part of the Agora. Made completely of marble, it stands on a large platform, 104 by 45 feet. The front and back, east and west sides, are adorned with six massive columns, the two longer sides with 13. Along the top are magnificent friezes, one of which depicts the labors of Heracles. Inside the temple in antiquity stood bronze statues of Hephaestus and Athena, the patron goddess of Athens. This testament to the architectural skills of ancient Greece stands virtually intact today, including its roof, appearing much as it did to the Athenians 25 centuries ago. A glorious temple that would have been observed in person by Euripides and Sophocles, by Socrates and Plato. High above the Agora to the southeast stands the Acropolis, home to numerous archaeological wonders, including the glorious temple of Athena Nike, the temple known as the Erechtheion, with its six enormous female statues, the Caryatids, and of course, chiefly the Parthenon, perhaps the most magnificent ruin of any kind to come down to us from classical antiquity. Although much larger than the temple of Hephaestus, the Parthenon took less time to complete, just 15 years. The temple is dedicated to Athena, the Parthenos, that is, the Virgin. But the building was not a cultic site devoted to her worship. It was instead used as a treasury for the city of Athens. The building is simply enormous. It stands on a base measuring 228 by 101 feet, on which stand eight giant columns on both front and back, 17 on each side. Their construction is an architectural marvel. If all the columns had been straight and exactly the same size, the building would appear curved to the naked eye. And so the architects designed the columns to lean slightly toward the interior of the building and enlarged them slightly in the middle. Moreover, the floor of the temple is imperceptibly higher in the center than at the sides. Altogether, these carefully plotted design features make the building appear completely straight and symmetrical. In antiquity, a statue of Athena stood inside the structure, measuring 12 meters high and constructed of fine ivory and gold around a wooden core. It was made by Phidias, the most famous sculptor of classical antiquity. Numerous other sculptures adorned the temple, including those known today as the Elgin Marbles, named after the man who pilfered them in the early 19th century, Thomas Bruce, 7th Earl of Elgin and British ambassador to the Ottoman Empire. The marbles can still be seen in all their relocated glory in the British Museum. The Temple of Hephaestus and the Parthenon were high on my agenda during my visit, as were the surrounding archaeological remains. But I was especially intent on climbing an otherwise unimpressive rock outcropping that, as a historian of early Christianity, I had known about since my youth. This is called the Areopagus, or Mars Hill. It is where the Apostle Paul allegedly delivered a speech to Epicurean and Stoic philosophers upon first arriving in Athens during his storied travels. The Areopagus today looks much as it did in Paul's time, a stony crag overlooking the city, boasting no ruins of any kind. Its only distinctive features are a plaque embedded in the rock below, encapsulating the text of the speech Paul delivered, and a set of slippery steps leading up to the top. It is a spectacular location, not because of any inherent merit or archaeological ruins, but because on both sides can be seen the vestiges of one of the most spectacular civilizations the world has ever known, the magnificent remains of the Agora below and the even more magnificent remains of the Acropolis above. This is Athens, the home of some of the greatest philosophers, dramatists, artists, architects, and political thinkers of classical antiquity, captured in a gaze downward and upward. Paul visited the spot on his second missionary journey, Acts 17. He had come to Athens to preach about Jesus and his resurrection. Some of his original audience wanted to hear more from him. So, as requested, he ascended the Areopagus to speak to a group of philosophers who regularly gathered there. He started his speech by mentioning he had seen a large number of temples and idols in their city, but was particularly struck by an altar dedicated to an unknown god. Scholars of early Christianity have long debated how to make sense of such an altar. Possibly it was erected as a backup measure by a group of pagans nervous about leaving a god out of their collective worship, in case there was one god who had been left unmentioned, unnamed, and unattended in the city. This altar was in that one's honor. Paul uses this altar to an unknown god as a launch pad for the rest of his address. The Athenians may not know who this god is, but Paul does. He, in fact, is the one god over all, the ultimate divine being, the God who created the heavens and the earth. As the creator of all things, he has no need for any physical representation or earthly temple. This is the God who is soon to judge the world and everyone on it through the second coming of his Son Jesus, whom God had raised from the dead. Paul's words did not find a welcome acceptance on the Areopagus. It is not that the philosophers there were shocked, dismayed, or challenged. They were simply amused. Paul was relatively uneducated, in comparison to them at least, and was speaking nonsense about a physical resurrection of the dead. Most of them mocked, although some wanted to hear more later. Paul did make one or two converts. While standing on the site 20 years ago, I thought about Paul, his sermon, and his surroundings. Paul was a lower-class artisan and itinerant preacher. From an external material perspective, nothing stood in his favor. He was widely maligned and mistreated, frequently beaten, sometimes within an inch of his life, and lacking any worldly power or prestige. In many ways, he stood on precisely the opposite end of the spectrum from the great cultural heroes of Athens, the heart of Greek civilization. Then the realization struck me. In the end, Paul won. What Paul preached that day on the Areopagus eventually triumphed over everything that stood below me in the Agora and above me on the Acropolis. It overwhelmed both the temple of Hephaestus and the Parthenon. No one, except probably Paul himself, would have predicted it. Yet it happened. Christianity eventually took over Western civilization. In this book, I have tried to explain the triumph of Christianity without making it a triumphalist narrative. As a historian, I do not think the Christianization of the Roman Empire was inevitable, and I do not celebrate it either as a victory for the human race and a sign of cultural progress on the one hand, or a major socio-political setback and cultural disaster on the other. I think it is impossible to say whether the world would have been a worse place or a better one had it not happened. Something else would have happened in its stead, but what? What would have happened if the Emperor Julian had ruled for 40 years instead of 19 months? Would he have managed to achieve his goal of marginalizing and then eliminating Christianity? Would the glories of Greece and Rome have lived on? Would what we think of as Western civilization ever have occurred? What would have happened if the Emperor Constantine had not won the battle at the Milvian Bridge, but instead died in the conflict? Would Christianity have sputtered and died? Or would the movement have continued to grow at an exponential rate? Would one of his emperor's sons have later converted? Or would persecution have continued and succeeded in quashing the faith? If so, what would have happened then? Even more, what difference would it have made to the world if Paul had not seen the light? Would someone else have arisen to take the gospel to the Gentiles, making possible the conversion of the entire pagan world, or would the religion have remained a sect of Judaism, with the historical importance of, say, the Jewish Essenes? We do not know, and we cannot know. We do know that Christianity won over the empire, and in doing so considered their historical movement a triumph. If about half the empire was Christian by the year 400 CE, the great majority was Christian by 500 CE. This Christianization brought massive benefits to the church. It went from being legalized under Constantine to being legislated under Theodosius to being the dominant religion of the West in the centuries to follow. Once emperors became Christian, masses came in, and of particular importance, the path was open for the aristocracy to follow. The leaders of the churches shifted from being simply local believers who happened to be literate to embodying the most highly educated, well-connected, politically astute, wealthy, and revered elements of society. The wealth and the power of the church itself became enormous. The wealth was evident not simply in magnificent church structures or their spectacular accoutrements, but in vast tracts of land and the holdings of the bishops. So, too, the power was not simply over the personal religious lives of the faithful. It was also social and political power. After the West saw its last Roman emperor with Romulus Augustulus in 476 CE, the church itself only grew in strength, as it did in the East as well. In fact, eventually the Roman popes claimed to rule the West. In the 8th century, or as one recent study has argued, in the 9th, there appeared a document known as the Donation of Constantine, in which the first Christian emperor allegedly bestowed the rule of all Western provinces on the Bishop of Rome. This is what Constantine is said to have written. As a return gift to the Most Blessed Bishop, our Father Sylvester, the Universal Pope, we decree that our palace, as well as the city of Rome and all the provinces, palaces, and cities of Italy and the Western regions, must be distributed to his power and the administration of his successor bishops. Through a firm imperial judgment and by means of this divine, sacred, and lawful constitution, we allow everything to remain under the jurisdiction of the Holy Roman Church. The document was not revealed to be a forgery until the middle of the 15th century. Before that, it was taken to authorize papal control of Western Europe. The 13th century Pope Gregory IX, Pope from 1227 to 1241, used the document to confront Frederick II, King of Sicily, arguing that Constantine had given to the Bishop of Rome the imperial insignia and scepter, the city with its entire duchy, and also the empire with perpetual oversight. More explicitly, Pope Boniface VIII, Pope from 1294 to 1303, declared, "I am Caesar, I am the emperor." How much more powerful could a leader of the church be? For him, the takeover of the empire was complete. This was a triumph indeed, but not obviously for everyone else. If victory for one means defeat for others, we might consider what was lost with the Christianization of the empire. On one level, it is impossible to say that Christianity caused the disappearance of so much that was lost. What we can say is that much that was alien to Christianity did indeed disappear. A great deal of pagan culture was eventually destroyed, or at least never renewed. We have seen the beginnings of the destruction in the 4th century with temples, shrines, and cult statues taken down and mutilated. Some, of course, remain, adorning many of the great museums of the world, or left in some instances intact at archaeological sites on their places of origin. But most went away forever, destroyed by fervent bishops or marauding monks. Other artifacts that were not made of marble and stone disappeared out of neglect. All sorts of literature gone forever. Thousands of books known and suspected to have once existed, plays, novels, poems, histories, philosophical works, scientific treatises, essays, name your genre. It is not that these were necessarily burned by zealous Christians opposed to the classics, although that sometimes did happen. Instead, they simply were never recopied for posterity. And for a simple reason. Copyists throughout the Middle Ages were almost invariably Christian monks working in monasteries. They were far more interested in producing copies of the letters of Paul than the plays of Plautus. Such pagan works may have been lost anyway, of course, without the Christianization of the empire, we can never say. Apart from artifacts of broader culture, there were losses sustained within the realm of religion itself. The triumph of Christianity meant a new kind of religiosity, and it is worthwhile thinking about the significance of the change. The Christianity that Theodosius and his successors promoted sometimes with vigorous legislation and imperial force, was strictly Nicene orthodoxy. This form of Christianity was doctrinaire, insisting on certain theological views as the only right basis for all religious belief. Variation, even in seemingly minute details of theological niceties, came to be disallowed. There was one form of truth, and eternal life depended on knowing what it was. One thing lost in this triumph was all the massive and glorious diversity of religious expression found everywhere throughout the pagan world. We can never lose sight of just how varied the thousands of pagan cults were. They did share common features, sacrifice and prayer, for example. But they involved the worship of different gods, known from different myths, adored through different practices, cults devoted to Zeus, to Athena, to Apollo, to Hephaestus, to gods of forests and streams and meadows, to gods of the household and gods of the family. As a rule, this enormous diversity brought with it a widespread tolerance of difference, a sense that varying paths to the divine were not only acceptable and allowed, but also desirable. Tolerance was to be encouraged. Freedom of religion was to be embraced. One of the greatest aspects of ancient paganism, taken as a whole, was the widespread willingness to accommodate and even revel in diversity. That was lost with the triumph of Christianity. But changed as well was a world that separated religion, ethics, philosophy, and myth into distinct spheres of human thought and life. Now, with the triumph of Christianity, there appeared on the scene a totalizing discourse about religion that encapsulated the totality of the lives of those who adhered to it, affecting not just their cultic practices, but also the moral precepts they followed, the stories they told about the divine, and the views they embraced, not just about God, but about reality itself. Christianity not only took over an empire, it radically altered the lives of those living in it. It opened the door to public policies and institutions to tend to the poor, the weak, the sick, and the outcast as deserving members of society. It was a revolution that affected government practices, legislation, art, literature, music, philosophy, and, on the even more fundamental level, the very understanding of billions of people about what it means to be human. However one evaluates the merits of the case, whether the Christianization of the West was a triumph to be treasured or a defeat to be lamented, no one can deny it was the most monumental cultural transformation our world has ever seen.
The Triumph of Christianity, How a Forbidden Religion Swept the World, was written by Bart D. Ehrman and read by George Newbern, with an introduction read by the author. Editing, mix, and post-production by Frog Pond Productions. The associate producer was Aaron Larson. The Triumph of Christianity, How a Forbidden Religion Swept the World, was produced by Tara Thomas. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Triumph of Christianity, How a Forbidden Religion Swept the World, is available in print from Simon & Schuster.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.